We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Well, welcome back. This is Hampton Keithley with Bob Brandon, and we are continuing and surprisingly concluding our book review of How the West Won by Rodney Stark. How are you today, Bob?
I'm not as cold as you, Hampton, even though my temperature's a little colder. I think you probably feel your temperature more than I do.
That's true. That's true. That dry cold is not as bad as the wet cold.
So you're about 42 and I'm 32, but 32 where I am is like fine. Like that sweatshirt, you go out in sweatshirt, but 42 where you are is sweatshirt inside.
That's true. And I sit right over the garage, which the cold air kind of seeps it up into my office.
Oh boy. Well, I really feel for you. How's this affecting your golf game?
I have the golf course to myself now when I go, when it's 42 degrees. So it improves my golf game.
I see. Well, are you ready for this stuff this morning?
I am.
This is an exciting
globalization
chapter.
And colonialism. The last chapter. We were both surprised that we were at the end of the book, because our Kindle said we were only 55% through, and that's only because the last half was footnotes.
Which is a good point. You know, when close to half of your work is just the annotation, you've done your homework.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not Stark just pontificating. It's Stark saying, here's the data. Here's what it shows. So, but how about, you're always good about letting me start out with some scripture. So how about if we read Matthew chapter 24, not the whole chapter, but the first 8 verses. And I'll just make one comment ahead of time so that when we read it, I don't have to break into the text, but there's going to be a point here real quick where Jesus, you know, talks about not one stone is going to be left upon another of the temple. And in history, that happened in 70 AD by the Roman general Titus destroyed the temple. His father, Vespasian, was the Roman emperor and had sent him to put down some rebellion in Judea. So he destroyed the temple and he wrote back to Vespasian, I left not one stone upon another. Not knowing, I don't think, that he's quoting Jesus, mm-hmm. but it's interesting. And then, so when my daughter was really young, you know, maybe 2 years old or something, and you know how kids like to break stuff sometimes. So we'd have these blocks and I'd build them up into some little tower, you know, just so that she could smash it and knock it down. And she would do it on command. And I would say, Sophia, leave not one stone upon another. And she would laugh and then knock it down. So anyway, here's Matthew chapter 24. Now, as Jesus was going out of the temple courts and walking away, his disciples came to show him the temple buildings. And he said to them, do you see all these things? I tell you the truth, Not one stone will be left upon another. All will be torn down. As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, his disciples came to him privately and said, "Tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Jesus answered them, "Watch out that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ.' They will mislead many. You'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. Make sure that you're not alarmed, for this must happen. But the end is still to come. For nation will rise up in arms against nations, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of birth pains." So that's as far as I wanted to read and just make the point. What an analogy, you know, birth pains. And that's how Stark's book has struck me, that it's not necessarily about the West winning, though I certainly understand what he's saying. And the truth of what he's saying is plain and obvious. But it's more to me about watching this creature be born, you know, having spent a lot of time and always will continue to spend a lot of time in the book of Daniel. Mm-hmm. And Daniel mentions, you know, those four beasts, and it's like it's as if you're seeing the fourth beast in the womb down through the centuries, and Western culture is the womb, you know, with which that beast is being formed and pretty soon to give birth. But anyway, thanks for letting me do that at the start.
You bet. Well, so chapter 18, globalization and colonialism. As we usually do, I think just reading his introduction sets up the thing the best. So although it is a long one, I'm going to do that.
Good.
Because with all the elements of Western modernity in place, this chapter turns to the ways by which it spread around the world. The primary means of cultural transmission was colonialism. In 1800, Europeans controlled 35% of the land surface of the globe. By 1878, this figure had risen to 67%. And then in the next two decades, Europeans seized control of nearly all of Africa, so that in 1914, on the eve of World War I, Europeans dominated 84% of the world's land area. The British Empire alone ruled about 25% of the Earth's inhabitants. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
It is. You know, you remember the nickname of the British Empire, the empire upon which the sun never sets?
Yes, I've heard that phrase.
Oh, isn't that a good one?
Yeah, very good. Everywhere Europeans ruled, Western culture quickly penetrated, aided by the fact that most colonial regimes established a substantial number of local schools. Nearly all modern accounts stress greed and racism as the basis for Europe's colonial expansion. Granted, both were significant factors, but so too were idealism and charity, especially on the part of Christian missionaries, who often were at least as concerned to educate and modernize foreign lands as to convert the world to Christ. For example, by 1910, British and American overseas mission organizations had established 86 colleges and universities, 522 teachers' colleges, or often referred to as normal schools, and thousands of elementary schools in Asia and Africa. Nor were missionaries the only idealists involved. The earliest British military intrusions into Africa were devoted mainly to stamping out the slave trade. During 1840 alone, the British Navy intercepted 425 slave ships off the West African coast. Hanged the slavers, not the slaves, returned the slaves to Sierra Leone and set them free. So you don't, you know, hear about.
You don't hear that. No.
Yeah, you don't hear about the good things they did.
No.
Now, of course, some instances of European colonialism were brutal and entirely exploitive, Belgian King Leopold II's rule of the Congo being the most notorious example. But while some individuals and companies profited greatly from colonialism, they usually did so at the expense of their fellow countrymen, since when government expenses are taken into account, European nations typically lost money on their colonial empires. It is worth remembering that the American Revolution was fought largely because the British Parliament, tired of losing money on the 13 colonies, tried to impose taxes sufficient to cover the costs of administering and defending them. So that's very common thing that is taught, is that
We raped the world, right?
Right.
We didn't at all. Most of the Europeans, as nations, lost money on the colonies.
Yeah. And he'll go into that a little more. Why then did Europeans establish colonies and try so hard to preserve them? Partly it was a matter of prestige. Many European leaders sought to expand their empires to qualify as world powers, and everyone cited the economic benefits of colonies for the fact that most, if not all, colonies were money-losing operations was not obvious and often required complex calculations. For example, the huge British Empire could not have existed without the superiority of the British Navy, but no naval costs were charged against the colonies, nor did anyone seem concerned about the costs to taxpayers of maintaining the huge number of British civil servants needed to rule and run the many colonies. These officials were drawn overwhelmingly from among the privileged, their ranks abounding in those with firsts from Oxford and Cambridge. Meanwhile, many powerful British families and firms grew rich from colonial commerce. They not only served as proof that colonies were a national asset, but also formed a potent lobby on behalf of imperial policies. It was the same in other European nations. Nevertheless, for the average European, colonialism was a losing proposition. I think that I kind of see a parallel with today. If you look at how much richer the big companies got during the vaccine COVID thing, right? One could argue that it was good for the economy,
certain sectors of it. No question.
So unfortunately, many social scientists remain convinced that colonialism was mainly responsible for the wealth of the West while causing underdevelopment or even substantial economic decline in the non-Western world. The facts are otherwise. Indeed, it is clear that the major impact of the West has been to immensely improve the quality of life in other parts of the world.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, how many, even in today's terms, remember, of course, World War II, Japan and Germany. Well, those countries are doing fine today, as right on the global scale, right? Their average quality of life for their citizens, even though they were defeated. Well, why is that? Well, it's because the U.S. poured tons of resources into them.
Right. Yeah, and we don't typically take, what was it, the Iraq War? Everybody said we fought it to get oil, but I don't think we took any oil. I think we spent a ton of money trying to help them become a democracy.
No, and on the other, that's right. On some of the, one of the funnier parts of it, I remember, during that Iraq war, this is just offhand, Hampton, allow me this mini rabbit trail. So, on the news one night, I remember one of the commentators was horrified because there's so many treasures of antiquity, in Mesopotamia.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had, a British guy come on and say, yeah, I know that museum was bombed there and it destroyed, the whatever artifacts. He goes, those weren't real. He goes, we took that stuff a long time ago and replaced it, with replicas. He goes, we have the real stuff.
That's funny.
Oh, that's funny.
So he says the next section is imperial technology. And basically, he's saying that Western technology was so superior to the rest of the world that it was easy to conquer them, and the temptations of such superiority were irresistible. And so then he goes into detail about like medicine. Between 50 to 75% of the Europeans who went to Africa died of malaria.
No, it's a horrible
And
disease.
so it wasn't, I don't remember what year, but quinine was developed. And then people stopped dying from malaria. And so then the rush to colonize began. And then the steamships was another thing of the technological marvel. Sailboats, the big galleons or whatever, could only go about 5 miles per hour. They couldn't sail directly in the direction they wanted unless the wind was blowing right behind them, or and so they'd have to go at angles sometimes. And so he says, although the British and the Portuguese managed to sustain colonies in that era, colonization became far easier when steam engines began to power ocean-going ships. Even more important was the introduction of the screw propeller to replace paddle wheels. This revolution in voyaging began in 1843 with the launching of the SS Great Britain. That steamship not only featured a screw propeller, but also was built of iron and was 322 feet long. The Great Britain could steam at 12 to 13 miles per hour and sail directly toward her destination. In 1845, she crossed the Atlantic in 14 days,
Remarkable.
compared with about 65 days for sailing ships. I mean, think
And then,
about trying to communicate,
oh,
from
right.
America to England, and it was minimum, what, 130 days
Right.
from the time someone could sail across and back. Now it's
Yeah, and I would imagine that depends on time of year. You know, those trade winds change
right.
and stuff with the seasons. Yeah. Oh goodness. It's hard to imagine. Even the technology just in our own lifetimes is like we talked about just the Kindle.
Yeah,
And
right.
then Hampton, how about the name of this next ship? This next big one, the
Dread.
Devastation.
Oh, yeah. Well, then down there is another one called the Dreadnought, 527 feet long. And it could go 24 miles per hour.
How big are they today? Do you know?
I have no idea.
Yeah, me neither.
So, let's see. Gunboats.
Oh, the Nemesis. Okay.
You like these names. The gunboats were smaller and enabled the, people to sail up these rivers. If you're in Texas and Colorado, you just really don't appreciate sailing up rivers or steaming up rivers. We
No.
have little rivers here fit for a
Well, the
canoe.
Rio, you got the Rio Grande down south. That's
Can walk across or swim across the Rio Grande. I
a
never will forget watching Hunt for Red October, I think it was. And at the end of the movie, they're sailing that gigantic submarine up the river. And I didn't appreciate the size of rivers until I went to an ETS meeting I don't remember where it was, Boston or something, but seeing the harbors there and the size of those rivers, I went, oh wow, you could sail some big boats up here. So, after gunboats, there were the rapid fire small arms was the next section.
Yeah, like the beginning of the machine gun and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, they did 1820. They had breech loading rifles where you could put this packet with the powder and the ball in the back of the gun. You didn't have to shove it down the barrel, so you could load while you were laying on the ground. In 1866, they had brass cartridges invented, and in 1884, the Hiram Maxim invented the machine gun, and it could go fire 600 rounds per minute.
Yeah.
And then
Sounds
the
like
tele,
ten a second.
yeah, t and then the telegraphs and the cables.
Right.
It said, slow communications long hindered colonialism. British officials in India could expect to wait at least a year for an answer to a letter sent to London. In the United States, during the War of 1812, fighting continued in Louisiana for some weeks before the combatants received word that a peace treaty had been signed. Then in 1837, the American Samuel F.B. Morse invented the telegraph.
So can I make a few comments on the telegraph stuff?
Yeah.
Just because it's fun. You know, one of my heroes is Tesla. And you know that I've mentioned a couple times that like Einstein was around that time, and the guy for GE, Steinmetz, was around that time. There was another genius around that time. It was like the age of geniuses.
Right.
It's a fascinating read. You know, they're in the electrical engineering annals of the day. This is fascinating, Hampton. One of the last entries, you know, around 1905, 1910, was that they felt they were on the verge of everything. Everything. They just thought nothing would be impossible to them. And it wasn't barroom talk. You know, it was written about. We're about to figure everything out, they thought. And then what happened, and why that didn't come to pass, I know this sounds really strange, but essentially it was Einstein, the theory of relativity, and those main players, you know, like Tesla, Steinmetz, and this other guy that I'm going to mention in a second, said that's not really right. It's not wrong as in like 2 + 2 = 5, but they did not think that was the real understanding,
explanation or understanding.
Yes. And so what happened is the world sort of, you know, these are of course huge generalizations, but the world kind of split into physicists, you know, that went with Einstein, and electrical engineering, which a lot of that went Einstein's way also, but a fair number of it, you know, went with Tesla and Steinmetz. But that's what happened in history. It's just a fascinating age. But this other guy I haven't mentioned yet. So, you know, this section in Stark talked about, you know, laying the cable between like New York and London. And when they first did that,
I can't imagine how they could do that.
That alone is, you know, doesn't engineering of mankind down through the ages just blow you away?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. So anyway, they lay these cables, and the first couple times, you know, they tried it out, it comes out all garbled. And they were really puzzled as to why. And a guy in England named Oliver Heaviside, self-educated, said, well, it's because this. You really have two waves going through that line, and the insulation that you've, you know, put on it is impeding one of the waves. So you need to change the insulation. And they did that, and it came out just right. So here's where you'll hear Oliver Heaviside's name. If you ever see the play Cats, in one of like the final song where old Deuteronomy is like being taken up to heaven, the chorus sings up, up, up to the Heaviside layer. And that's named for Oliver Heaviside. He's a fascinating genius. And he was one of the prime guys that when Einstein came out, he said, that's not exactly right. And so anyway, it just was fun for me to read that section, you know, knowing some of that background to it.
Oh, yeah. Good. His next section is the Age of Imperialism. And I'll read the first paragraph. The age of imperialism was shorter and more recent than many realize, coming to full flower from 1870 to 1914. As for the extent of Western imperialism, the prominent historian D.K. Fieldhouse observed that it is easier to list the few places which were not and had never been under European domination than to name those which were. Turkey, parts of Arabia, Persia, Afghanistan, Tibet, China, Mongolia, Siam, Japan, a number of small islands, the Arctic, and the Antarctic. Everything else was either part of the West or a colony. Even some of the places that weren't actual colonies were subject to a considerable degree of Western control, China being a good example.
Right. Yeah, England had the empire upon which the sun never sets. I remember looking this up in the 80s, so I don't know if it's changed in the last 40 years, but if you asked the trivia question, what foreign nation owns the most American assets? The answer in the 80s was England. They used to own the whole thing. But you don't necessarily think in those terms, but they've Britain's influence was, you could scarcely imagine it.
Right. He does talk about King Leopold, really abused the King Leopold II.
Yeah, the Belgian guy.
He really abused the people in the Congo and killed, several million Africans died while he was in control. And he said missionaries were instrumental in getting an international commission involved, and they removed him, and the Belgian government took over, but the abuses continued. And then he said Congo gained independence in 1960, and now African tyrants abused the people. And so, sounds like a bad place to live. But
Brutal environment.
yeah. So, he also mentioned, well, it says at the other end of the spectrum, because so he's basically saying there were abuses. But at the other end of the spectrum were the British colonies. Granted, the British sometimes were oppressive and ruthless, but they also were concerned to improve the circumstances of their colonial subjects. This sense of obligation was expressed in Rudyard Kipling's phrase, the white man's burden. Do you ever remember hearing that phrase?
Yes, not really understanding it, but I remember hearing it.
Yeah. So today that phrase is uniformly condemned as unmitigated racism. And without a doubt is reflecting it, it reflected the routine racism of the day. But for many British civil servants, as well as missionaries serving abroad, it also reflected their conviction that those enjoying the benefits of modernity had an obligation to share it with those less fortunate.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, two of the darkest blots on the British colonial record involve the brutal mistreatment of white subjects. And he talked about the potato famine in Ireland when the Irish starved while the English landlords sold all their, corn and potatoes back to England or something. And then the other was in the Boer Wars in South Africa. And so it was actually whites that were oppressed the most by the British colonial. And I don't know if you know this, but that Boer Wars was where Winston Churchill gained his military experience.
I did not know this.
So he was quite brave. I remember reading this, something about him during that time. He says the most admirable aspects of British colonialism involve the immense efforts devoted to education and health. Colonial administrators and the educators they hired were responsible for some of these achievements. But just as important were the thousands of missionaries, as Americans as well as British, who flocked to the colonies.
It's kind
And
of, oh, go ahead.
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that it kind of strikes me, how you can read things like this happens in the scripture all the time, doesn't it? Like you'll be reading a certain section and it'll strike you in a certain way. And it strikes you in such a way, it's like as if you never read it before, even though you had, right? It strikes you anew because you have different things in your mind, So when I read this, the colonial administrators and educators they hired were responsible for some of these achievements, but just as important were the thousands of missionaries who flocked to the colonies. And what they had talked about, that's not exactly the, I started one sentence too late. the first sentence was the efforts that were devoted to education and health. If you were to like have a sonogram, right, back to our metaphor of giving birth to the final pagan kingdom on earth, if you had a sonogram and you were watching that development, would you have picked ahead of time that health would be the lever that would be used to control the world?
No.
I wouldn't have either. And yet, that's what's happening today. It's interesting. We'll talk about that later a little bit.
That's a good point. His next section is missionary effects. And I think this first paragraph is so applicable to today. So think about parallels, I guess, as we read it. Perhaps sure. The most bizarre of all the charges leveled against Christian missionaries, along with colonialists in general, is that they imposed modernity on much of the non-Western world. It has long been the received wisdom among anthropologists and other cultural relativists that by bringing Western technology and learning to native peoples, the missionaries corrupted their cultures, which were as valid as those of the West. This, quote, cultural imperialism is defined as imposing Western tastes, beliefs, and practices upon non-Western cultures. Admittedly, the English may have committed an abomination when they converted so many colonials to the game of cricket.
Did you see him laughing there when he's yeah. writing that?
Yeah. And the worldwide popularity of Coca-Cola may not have made the world a better place. But to embrace the fundamental message of cultural imperialism requires that one be comfortable with such crimes against women as foot binding, female circumcision, the custom of Sadi. I don't remember what, I don't know how to pronounce that, but that's where they burn the widows with their husbands. Funeral pyres, and the stoning to death of rape victims on grounds of their adultery. It also requires one to agree that tyranny is every bit as desirable as democracy, and that slavery should be tolerated if it is in accord with local customs. Similarly, one must classify high infant mortality rates, toothlessness in early adulthood, and the castration of young boys as valid parts of local cultures to be cherished along with illiteracy, for it was especially on these aspects of non-Western cultures that modernity was imposed, both by missionaries and by other colonialists.
Yeah, there you go.
And he goes on to say that the more missionaries a country had, the more likely it was to develop democracy.
Well, aren't those statistics fun? That was a great study, right?
Mm-hmm.
Read some of that.
You go ahead. What stood out to you?
Well, so a remarkable new study by Robert Woodbury has demonstrated conclusively that Protestant missionaries can take most of the credit for the rise and spread of stable democracies in the non-Western world. That is, the greater the number of Protestant missionaries per 10,000 local population in 1923, the higher the probability that by now a nation has achieved a stable democracy. The missionary effect is far greater than that of 50 other pertinent control variables, including gross domestic product and whether or not a nation was a British colony. Woodbury not only identified this missionary effect, but also gained important insights into why it occurred. Missionaries, he showed, contributed to the rise of stable democracies because they sponsored mass education, local printing and newspapers, and local voluntary organizations, including those having a nationalist and anti-colonial orientation. These results so surprised social scientists that perhaps no study ever has been subjected to such intense republication vetting. Woodbury was required to turn over his entire database to editors of the American Political Science Review, who subjected it to extensive independent reanalysis. But after this vetting, the editors were satisfied that the robust statistical results were correct. In fact, they gave Woodbury considerably more space than the usual maxim to present his findings in detail. Is that not fascinating?
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, even that kind of research, who thinks to do that? How painstaking that must have been, but how valuable.
Well, and it went so against the
grain. Yeah.
The social imaginary.
Exactly. We'll have to bring that up in a minute.
Yeah. I don't know how long ago that was. Did he say?
Well, he says, like, you would think it's almost in his lifetime. I didn't go look at the date on the footnote.
Yeah.
But he said a remarkable new study. So I imagine it's fairly recent, within 30 or 40 years, I'd bet.
Very interesting. Yeah, missionaries were the ones that built schools, colleges, medical clinics, hospitals. Infant mortality rates went down. Life expectancy went up. And he says, if these effects constitute, quote, cultural imperialism, close quote, so be it.
Yeah, so be it. You know, and people that want to argue with you on this stuff, well, here's the data.
Yeah. Right. Well, go. That's so different than, I mean, in the last decade. You know, they just don't look at the data anymore.
No.
I mean, if you have it, they censor you or whatever.
Yeah.
Colonialism and underdevelopment. In 1902, the English economist J.A. Hobson published Imperialism, a book in which he charged that the industrial European nations looted their colonies by forcing them to sell their raw materials too cheaply and to buy manufactured goods at too high a price. In 1915, Lenin, soon to lead the Russian Revolution, essentially plagiarized Hobson's book, including his statistics, for a book he titled Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism.
Now, who's that Lenin? That's not the guy who started communist Russia, is it? Oh, it is.
It is.
Plagiarized somebody else's faulty work. Okay, go ahead. Yeah. I just wanted to.
Thanks for pointing that out. Ever since, it has been an article of faith on the extreme left that Western nations stole their wealth from the non-Western nations, and in doing so, prevented them from modernizing. This line has, of course, been popular in the less developed nations. It tells them that their lack of progress is not their fault, but is imposed upon them by the developed world. Unfortunately, this claim also proved to be popular among Western social scientists. During the 70s, there arose a group of social scientists who identified themselves as world systems theorists, led by Emmanuel Wallerstein, Andre Gunder Frank, and a cast of supporting players. World systems theory was, for several decades, the prevailing view in academia, despite its obvious incompatibility with basic facts.
Yeah, it's almost like you got to read that twice.
And so he goes into, you know, detail to prove what the basic, you know, the conflict. But the facts are that trade statistics prove the opposite. There's no correlation between raw material exports and a nation's GDP. And the amount of the exports is trivial. And back to the missionary thing, he said, you know, the missionary effect was way more important than the GDP stuff.
Right.
So, and then at the end, he says, although modernity has spread around the globe, in many places, what has arisen is not Western modernity. Instead, technological aspects of modernity have been grafted onto non-Western cultural systems that still lack many of the basic political and moral aspects of Western civilization. As Samuel P. Huntington noted so perceptively, many observers mistakenly see the worldwide popularity of Western consumer products such as Coke and Levi's as reflecting the development of a universal civilization, but to do so trivializes Western cultures. Western culture. In Arab societies, many people own cell phones and drive automobiles, and the armies have an abundance of modern weapons. But to the extent that this reflects modernity, it is modernity by purchase and import. These are not industrial societies, nor are they modern in most other aspects. There are no Arab democracies. Women have few rights and religious intolerance is the rule. Even successfully building an industrialized society is not tantamount to becoming modern in the Western sense, as the case of China illustrates. To use the classic phrase of scholar Carl A. Wittfogel, coined more than half a century ago, modern China remains an Oriental despotism. A substantial degree of individual freedom is inseparable from Western modernity, and this still is lacking in much of the non-Western world. No doubt Western modernity has its limitations and discontents. Still, it is far better than the known alternatives, not only or even primarily because of its advanced technology, but because of its fundamental commitment to freedom, reason, and human dignity.
Yeah, very good.
So I was thinking about this, and I said, you know, if we incorporate a bit of Carl Truman here and what we learned from that book, we could say that the left hates Western culture with its Christianity, its resulting morality, and the resulting individual freedoms, which Stark just talked about. And of course, they enjoy the modern conveniences of technology, which makes them hypocrites, right?
Yes.
But they think they can have all that in their preferred command economies. But instead, the command economy, they kill the motivation to be productive, and they run the society into the ground.
Yes. So
they try to discredit Western civilization to gain their power. And I think this was an important chapter because it takes to task the modern sentiment that it is prideful for me to think that Western culture is better.
Well, you run into that, don't you? If you even make an offhand comment about it, you run into it right away.
Well, it's everywhere. I've been talking with Lori a few months ago when we started this book. I think we're on the way to church. She says, "What are y'all talking about on the podcast?" And I said, "Well, we're talking about how, you know, the rise of Western civilization happened and why other cultures remained backwards." And when I used the word backwards, she was offended. And when she was like, "You can't say that, you know."
Sure you can.
And so, you know, that's the social imaginary, is that, you know, it's wrong to think that Western civilization is better.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, maybe the way we could clarify it is, you know, better with regards to what? And as we've said numerous times, that Western culture is more, it's not fully, it's just more in accordance with what a human being really is, right? That's right. Why it's superior, because it corresponds to that. The human being is the image of God. So Western culture has more closely, again, nowhere near perfectly, but more closely corresponded to that. And so the human being thrives under governments that govern in accordance with what a human being really is. And like when you mentioned, you know, command economies, that's the opposite.
Right.
So...
Well, the lack of the founding fathers, when we talked about that, you know, they knew that our democracy was dependent on us having a moral society.
Yes.
And having a moral society is dependent on having a Christian-based society.
Yeah. And the education that goes with all that. Yeah. That's right.
It's all tied together.
Very good. Well, thanks for choosing this book.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
So I wanted to make a few comments like we did last time, if that's okay, unless you have something else you want to say about Stark. I recommend the book, Get Stark's book, because we just breeze through it, all the data that's in there. Like we mentioned privately, I had no idea we were getting to the end of the book when I, hit the side of the Kindle to go to the next page. It said notes. And I remember being a little surprised because I had looked at, how far I was in the book, and it's like 57%.
Yeah, that's what mine says. I'm thinking, wow, we're only halfway through this book.
Yeah, well, half of the book is footnoted, is the footnotes.
Right.
So you need that research at your fingertips. But anyway, if we're done with that, I wanted to read. Remember last time we introduced the book, The Fourth Reich, and we read just a little bit of that woman that really puts all her efforts into understanding the VAERS data. There's another chapter that I wanted to touch on. All of the chapters in here are very good. A chapter is just an interview with a different player in the COVID game. So this chapter is on David Martin. And you're familiar with who he is, but I'll read a little
Canadian?
bit. I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. But
Okay,
we'll
go
re
ahead.
yeah. So we'll read about his background and the things he has to say, because they're kind of mind-blowing. So I'll try not to rant and instead just
Just the
read
facts, ma'am. Just the facts.
just the facts. There you go. So let's get into his background a little bit. So the interviewer, that's either Dace or Horowitz, they're the guys who wrote this book. They ask him, "You have an extensive background in healthcare, technology, and more. Can you itemize some of that experience for us?" Hey, Hampton, this is so hard to read because it's as if you're going, "Do you ever sleep? How old are you? And have you ever slept?" And you know who another guy is like that? Literally, Tesla hardly ever slept. Literally, maybe three hours a night at the
Yeah.
most. He would go days without sleeping because he was working on something. So these guys, you can't even imagine how much background they have. So here he's going to describe it. He says, "My undergraduate degrees are in biology, psychology, and sports medicine. I have a master's in physiology. My doctorate is in radiology and orthopedic surgery, engineering, and sports medicine at the University of Virginia. I joined the med school faculty there in the early 90s. Also, during the 1990s, I founded and ran Mosaic Technologies, which was a treaty-restricted technology transfer company. Our business was to get into countries that were mostly precluded from exporting offensive military technologies during the Second World War and the treaties thereafter, and find military technologies that could be exported as civilian technologies." Did you ever have that desire to do that? Did you ever sit around and think, I wonder what?
No.
Okay. Well, that's in the middle of your operations and your other stuff and your faculty requirements. Okay. Then he says, "I've also been very involved in S investigating biological and chemical weapons capabilities and violations around the world for the US government. I published the official document on an annual basis that recorded globally all biological and chemical weapons facilities, who was funding them, what they were doing." So in your spare time, did you ever think of doing that?
That sounds like a full-time job, just doing that.
That work made me familiar with people like Ralph Baric and Anthony Fauci way back in the 90s when they took the spike protein associated with coronavirus and weaponized it to target human tissues, including lung and heart tissue, under the cover of an effort to create a vaccine vector that could be used for an HIV vaccine.
This
Thus,
is 90s.
way back to, going back to the 90s. Thus, as you can see, I've had a hand in things ranging from medical technologies, stealth antenna, radar, nuclear medicine, and all sorts of other things. Here's another thing he did that he's not even saying. He's often used by the government to crack like tax fraud, because he's sort of like one of these systems analysis guys, and he has these computer systems that can track data that you and I would never even think you could track. And so he's able to find where companies are hiding money and stuff like that. He's cracked a couple of huge cases. The government uses him for that. Mm-hmm. Hey, that's in addition to this other stuff he said.
So this basically, this is a competent guy. A Superman.
There you go. So let's hear his take on this. Here's the question. Is it your view COVID-19 did not happen spontaneously, that those behind all of this didn't merely take advantage of an organic crisis to advance an agenda, but caused the crisis themselves? Here's his answer. Yes, but it's not just my assertion. I have over 4,000 pieces of documented evidence to show that from 1999 through September 2019, this entire terror campaign was organized and funded through National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. For example, in October of 2014, NIAID told the University of North Carolina to continue their gain-of-function work on the spike protein from the Wuhan coronavirus model, despite the moratorium against it. There's not even a question this was premeditated. The goal early on was finding a way to weaponize what had been for two decades prior a concern of veterinary medicine. Most coronavirus infections prior to 1999 were contained to dogs and pigs, and it was usually a gastrointestinal target, not a cardiac or respiratory one. It was Barrick who turned it into a device that could target the human heart and lungs. There's no accident anywhere in this. It's exceptionally clear from the evidence I've been briefing since the early 2000s that this is a known and planned weapons program. It had nothing to do with public health or any of the alleged nightmarish scenarios we were told in late 2019 or early 2020. In early 2015, in a critical admission of racketeering and domestic terrorism, Peter Daszak, the head of Eco Health Alliance, stated to the National Academy of Sciences, to sustain funding based beyond the crisis, we need to increase the public understanding of the need for medical countermeasures, such as a pan-coronavirus vaccine. A key driver is the media, and the economics will follow the hype. We need to use that hype to our advantage to get to the real issues. Investors will respond if they see profit at the end of the process. I'm not making an allegation. It's their own admission. I have the documentation. They stated that this was a domestic terror campaign, and they stated it during the gain of function moratorium. So let's read on just a little bit. Are you suggesting this just about the creation of the virus, or are you saying it about the creation and the release of the virus? So Martin says, we need to be precise in this because we're being misled by the cunning use of language. Coronavirus is a model of what is called a clade, or a subspecies of virus. Coronavirus is a descriptor of one type of virus, but the fact of the matter is that there is not a single coronavirus. In 2003, during the first SARS outbreak, which we were told was also an accident, the CDC's first patent was filed on the genome of SARS coronavirus, was ironically the U.S. government seeking to control the genome of the subclade referred to as SARS. What we've had in the past 2.5 years has not been a virus outbreak. Let's pause there for a second. How many people do you think believe it was a virus outbreak?
99.9%.
That's what I'd say. I mean, I'd say that many people believe that. That's not what's going on. Is that not mind-blowing?
That is.
So I know. So he says it was not a virus outbreak. It has been the deployment of a spike protein weapon that has been known and improved upon over the last 2 decades since the first patent. Barrick said in 2016, when he was speaking at the Wuhan Institute, that a SARS coronavirus targeting human tissue was poised for human emergence. Well, how would he know that? Because the proverbial guns were loaded and ready to be deployed. So once again, this is not an assertion. It's an open and shut case. Go back and look at the 2003 patent. The U.S., led by the likes of Fauci and Barrick, allegedly took what was described by the Chinese and turned it into an invention owned by the U.S. through the CDC, which was given complete control of the commercial deployment of a coronavirus weapon, specifically the SARS coronavirus with its corresponding spike protein. And he goes on. I mean, I'd read it all day long if you would let me. But
well, the two things that stand out to me is the hubris of the people to document what they're doing.
Yes.
And so we have, you know, irrefutable proof that this all, you know, this is bad and
yeah,
it's on purpose. And then we also, with that kind of proof, there was nobody to go to in the government that was above reproach and not compromised, you know, had not been blackmailed by Epstein or, you know, some whatever. There's nobody that can take these people down.
Right.
There's no justice. That's the
exactly
thing.
No, you're exactly right. They've corrupted the institutions. There's nowhere to turn for redress. And you're right. Remember, I forget what big subject we were on, but we would refer now and then to Hannah Arendt, a philosopher who died maybe 20 years ago or so, a German woman, German Jew. But she said concerning the Vietnam War, once the Pentagon Papers were published after the war, she said all of the information that was revealed in the Pentagon Papers had been available the entire time. But the social imaginary keeps you from seeing it. So what David Martin is saying, and I just read a little section, right? That goes on for 20 pages of the kind of detail he's giving. He's not speculating. He's reading their patents and he's reading their own documents.
Right.
This material is available to everybody. You don't have to wonder what Corona is. You don't have to wonder what the vaccine is. They've patented all of this for the last 20 years. It's a plan, and he documents in their own statements, you know, where they say their goal is to reduce the world population by 15%. They're going to achieve that.
Yeah.
So even in a simplistic way, like remember last week we looked at the VAERS stuff, and that doctor was saying the cutoff for stopping a vaccine is if the vaccine killed 50 people. It did that in the first day.
Right.
That's been going on for 3 years. Every day you can look at VAERS, the weekly deaths, the smallest I've ever seen. And this is keeping in mind that the numbers we're seeing the real numbers are at minimum 30 times bigger. Everybody acknowledges that. I'd say it's 100 times bigger. But even if you just take the numbers they're providing, the smallest number I've ever seen per week is 50 per week. Well, why aren't they stopping it? See, that question alone will clarify everything about this. They're not stopping it because they want it to happen. Your government is killing you on purpose. I know how staggering that sounds, but
Yeah. Well, we just learned about how the West won. Now we're watching it lose. So,
how the West created the womb of the fourth beast.
yeah.
Okay, champ. Thanks for letting me rant.
You bet. Well, we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.